It's weird how it happens. We get a bit of something we really like, a flurry of Instagram likes, a glass of wine, a chocolate chip cookie, or a cigarette, and the dopamine our brain churns out in response makes us feel really good. But often, rather than eliminating our craving for whatever it is that pleases us, the first dose drives us toward a second, a third, a fourth. After a while, it takes more and more just to arrive at that feeling we once got from the first drink or the first cookie. And the come down feels worse. But some of us find it really hard to stop, even when we know our habits have grown beyond our control. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Dr. Anna Lemke has spent her career studying how all this works, and she's drawn some fascinating conclusions. One is that our brain's natural tendency to chemically balance pleasure with pain, that dopamine deficit that follows the dopamine surge, is such a major factor in our drug-seeking behavior that it could also play a role in helping us regain control. Dr. Lemke is medical director of Stanford Addiction Medicine and chief of the Stanford Addiction Medicine Dual Diagnosis Clinic. Her book is called Dopamine Nation: Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. She joined us in February. Anna, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
You have worked with people battling all kinds of addictions, drugs and alcohol, the things we expect, but also sex and video games and gambling and food. How does our ability to access whatever gives us problems affect the chances we will become hooked on it?
It's a great question. You know, there are many different risk factors for developing addiction, but one of the biggest risk factors is simple access to the drug. If we live in a neighborhood where drugs are sold on the street corner, where they're easier to get, we're more likely to try them and more likely to get addicted. If we go to see a doctor who's free with their prescription pad when it comes to opioids or Xanax, we're more likely to try them, more likely to get addicted. And of course, now in this digital age, we have almost infinite access to highly reinforcing drugs and behaviors, including some that didn't even exist before.
You find that lower income people without a lot of education are at particular risk of developing addictions. Why would that be the case?
Well, when you think about the kinds of, well, first of all, it's a known risk factor for addiction, unemployment, poverty, multi-generational trauma. These are all known risk factors. But, you know, one of the key pieces of getting into recovery from addiction and staying in recovery is having access to healthy sources of reward or healthy sources of dopamine. And many times people living in poverty don't have those kinds of privileges. They don't necessarily have access to nature, which is a healthy source of dopamine. They don't necessarily have access to, healthier kinds of foods. So, people living in poverty are at great risk for not having access to healthy sources of dopamine, while they still have tremendous access to unhealthy sources of dopamine that are so available and ubiquitous now.
It might be easy to listen to this conversation and think, oh, I'm really sorry for all those other people who are struggling with addiction. But you point out, if we count the trouble that most of us have, at the very least putting our phones down these days, almost all of us have some level of addiction working.
That's right. And the reason is because our world has become drugified. Almost everything from shopping to finding a partner to eating food to playing games has been made more potent, more reinforcing, more accessible, such that it's hard to really do anything in the modern world that doesn't have the potential for addiction. And so I think this is a really important point, because we are seeing increasing rates of addiction, but we're also seeing increasing rates of these minor overconsumption, compulsive overconsumption problems. And that's because of the environment that we've created in which even previously healthy kinds of behaviors have now been drugified in some way.
You also worry that we're setting our children up to struggle with overuse and addiction, in part because we've gone out of our way to kind of strip their lives of any experience with failure or struggle or disappointment. How is that overprotecting of kids and the pathologizing of every bad experience, even in a pretty normal childhood, how does that backfire?
Well, it backfires because by depriving our children of challenging and even painful experiences, what we're essentially doing is depriving them of the opportunity to build up the mental calluses that they need to endure, you know, as adults and you know, make it in this world and have a meaningful and flourishing life. So although it comes from a good place, this wanting to protect our children from painful experiences, it ultimately does them a huge disservice. And it happens on a physiologic level. So it's not just sort of the psychological narratives or touchstones, although those play a role. Actually, physiologically, by exposing ourselves and our children to challenging and painful situations, we're telling the body to upregulate our feel-good hormones like dopamine and actually making ourselves happier and healthier. So it's very important that we do that when we're raising our children.
What do you mean when you say one reason we're so miserable might be that we're trying so hard to avoid being miserable?
Well, that really comes down to the neuroscience of pleasure and pain. And, you know, one of the most interesting findings in neuroscience in the last 50 years or so is that the same parts of the brain that process pleasure also process pain, and they work like opposite sides of a balance. So if you imagine a teeter-totter in a kid's playground. So when we do something, you know, highly pleasurable, the balance tilts to this pleasure side. We get a release of dopamine, our pleasure neurotransmitter, and that feels good, and we want to do it again. But what most people don't realize, and this is what the neuroscience has shown, is that one of the overarching rules governing this balance is that it wants to remain level, and it restores a level balance by first tilting an equal and opposite amount to the side of pain. So that's the come down, the after effect, the hangover, or the downregulation of our dopamine transmission. And I always imagine that as these little neuroadaptation gremlins hopping on the pain side of the balance to bring it level again, but they like it on the balance, so they stay on till it's tipped an equal and opposite amount to the side of pain. And the bottom line is, if we continue to ingest highly reinforcing substances and behaviors, then we accumulate more and more gremlins on the pain side of the balance till we have enough gremlins to fill a whole room, and then we're essentially in a dopamine deficit state. And that's the addicted brain. When we reach that state, now we need pleasure just to restore a level balance and feel normal. And when we're not using, we're experiencing the universal symptoms of withdrawal from any addictive substance, which are anxiety, irritability, insomnia, dysphoria, and craving. So my hypothesis is that one of the reasons that the rates of depression, anxiety, and suicide are going up, especially in rich nations, is not because we're experiencing trauma or because, you know, of like socioeconomic differences, although both trauma and socioeconomic disparity play a role, but rather because we're bombarding our brain's reward pathway with too much pleasure, and our brains are reeling from this and attempting to compensate by downregulating our own production of dopamine, leading to this dopamine deficit state, which is essentially akin to a clinical depression.
Why can't our brains just let us enjoy that dopamine without, you know, offering a come down that happens after?
It's a great question, right? It seems like a cruel trick of Mother Nature to do that to us. But if you think about it, our brains have evolved over millions of years of scarcity and ever-present danger to have us avoid pleasure. I mean, approach pleasure and avoid pain. And of course, this is highly adaptive in a world of scarcity. If you think about it, what better way to get us to continue to seek for pleasure than to make sure that pleasures are fleeting and that on the heels of pleasure comes pain, which then motivates us to seek out more of our drug. The problem is that we no longer live in the world for which our brains have evolved. We now live in a world of hyper-convenient, overwhelming abundance. And so I think that this mismatch between our primitive wiring and our modern ecosystem has led to a lot of misery.
You explained in the book that dopamine may play a bigger role in the motivation to seek a reward than the pleasure of that reward itself. Why is that significant here?
Well, that's significant because dopamine itself is neither good nor bad. It's a signal. We have a tonic baseline firing amount of dopamine constantly. What's salient for the brain is whether there's a deviation from that baseline up or down. When we do something pleasurable, we get an increase in dopamine. But remember, the way that the brain compensates for that increase is by then downregulating dopamine transmission, not just to baseline, but below baseline. And that's that state of craving. So dopamine, yes, it's about the experience of pleasure and reward, but it's also about that dopamine deficit state, which then drives the wanting and the craving and the sort of physiologic compunction to do the work to get more of the drug. So dopamine has a funny way of being both good and bad, depending upon where it is in relation to baseline levels.
Anna, does it go too far to say that regardless of our poison or the thing we're using more than is good for us, what we really become addicted to is that dopamine response?
Yeah, I mean, it's important to recognize that we don't actually ingest dopamine. If you were to eat a spoonful of dopamine, it wouldn't even go into your brain because it doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier. Dopamine is a chemical that we make in our brain in response to things in our environment that are either pleasurable or painful. And the more reinforcing something is, the more dopamine is released in the reward pathway and the more pleasurable that experience is. So, ultimately, yes, it's about the sort of relative nature of the dopamine.
There are so many people struggling to get off opioids, but some of those who started taking those medications in response to physical pain actually find their pain is worse after a dose of what was supposed to make them feel better than it was before they took the medication. What is the mechanism there?
So this is essentially that pleasure-pain balance at play and neuroadaptation. And this was really an aha moment for me in my career as I was seeing these patients with terrible chronic pain who had been on high-dose opioids for very long periods of time, who essentially had worse pain than when they started. And when we slowly and carefully tapered them off of opioids, their pain improved. And that can 100% be understood from the perspective of this dopamine transmission system, this pleasure-pain balance, where with repeated exposure to the same or similar stimulus, our brain essentially downregulates dopamine receptors, opioid transmission, and we get into this dopamine deficit state or this pleasure-pain balance with gremlins sort of camped out on the pain side. And now we need more and more of that opioid just to feel normal. And when we're not using it, we're in this pain, including physical pain. And we're seeing, rising rates of physical pain in rich nations, especially the United States, including in otherwise healthy young people who have no objective findings of disease and for which there's kind of a mysterious pain syndrome. And I think it's possible that we're dealing, again, with sort of the absence of painful experiences, including physically painful experiences in our lives, are actually resetting our pleasure, pain, and opioid systems so that we're more vulnerable to experiencing pain and less able to access pleasure.
So the more we try to protect ourselves, the worse we make it down the road.
That's right, because again, our ancient wiring, which has been conserved over millions of years of evolution and across species, was wired for pain. It's wired for living in a place where it's really, really hard to find pleasures. But that's, not the world we live in now. And so, we're experiencing this incredible kind of disconnect.
All right, Anna, I will tell you I'm ready for some good news here. And there is good news, right? How can we reset our brain's pain and pleasure balance so that it's not out of whack?
Yeah, so it's basically a three-step approach. The first thing is to abstain for at least 30 days from our drug of choice to give enough time for dopamine balance to be restored. That is to say, for those neuroadaptation gremlins to hop off the pain side of the balance so that we can experience pleasure in other more modest rewards, but also get perspective on our use. And of course, we can't rely on willpower alone to abstain for that length of time. We have to engage in what I call self-binding strategies. These are ways of creating literal and metacognitive barriers between ourselves and our drug of choice. The second thing is to actually intentionally press on the pain side of the balance. Those neuroadaptation gremlins I spoke of are agnostic to whatever the initial stimulus was. If we press on pleasure, they'll hop on the pain side and reset us to the side of pain. But if we press on the pain side of the balance, they will happily jump on the pleasure side and reset us to the side of pleasure. So that means doing things that are physically and mentally hard for us. It's the science of hormesis. Hormesis is Greek for to set in motion. And basically, when we engage in things like exercise, ice cold water bath, or even just doing something that's cognitively or emotionally challenging, what we're doing is telling our body to upregulate production of our own endogenous dopamine and other feel-good hormones and neurotransmitters. And then the third thing is to engage in what I call radical honesty. That's to tell the truth about things large and small. And that has an amazing and mysterious ability to help us manage our compulsive overconsumption. First, it holds us accountable to ourselves and others. Second, it fosters intimacy, because when we're telling the truth to other people about the things we're doing that we're maybe a little ashamed of, we think they're going to go running screaming from us, but in fact, it draws us closer and they see that they're not the only ones struggling with that type of problem. But it's also true that telling true autobiographical narratives about our lives not only help organize our past, but also create a roadmap for the future, kind of signposts for how to live life. And so it has this amazing ability to tell honest stories about ourselves, which then allow us to make better decisions going forward.
That was a great summary of all this, and it's really interesting, but I want to go into a bit more detail here. So this self-binding, this 30-day break we can take from the thing we have a problem with, how do we prepare ourselves for the fact that we're going to feel a lot worse without the thing we have used too much of before we start feeling better?
Yeah, excellent point. And it's one thing I always warn my patients about. They will feel worse before they feel better. When we give up that thing that we reach for to distract ourselves or chase away our worries or numb ourselves or make ourselves feel good, what happens is those neuroadaptation gremlins, unopposed, crash our balance to the side of pain. And that's withdrawal. And remember, universal symptoms of withdrawal are anxiety, irritability, insomnia, and dysphoria. But I always tell my patients, it's time limited. If you can just hang in there, usually by weeks 3 or 4, those gremlins start to hop off and people start to feel better. A couple caveats to this intervention. I would obviously not recommend this intervention for someone who had repeatedly tried to stop on their own and was unable to. They would need a higher level of care. I also wouldn't recommend it for someone who is physically dependent on something like Xanax or alcohol, for which there can be a life-threatening withdrawal syndrome.
But plenty of people are sort of emotionally dependent on alcohol without being physically dependent to the extent that stopping will create withdrawal. What does it take for people to get through those 3 or 4 weeks? And what happens at the end of it that allows at least some people, you think, to experiment with using in a way that is healthy and moderate rather than out of control?
Well, what gets people to engage in the 30-day fast, and I really do talk about it as an experiment. It's really a biological experiment. I mean, one of the best ways to understand biological systems is to change something about the system and see what happens. And what I say to patients is, you know, it may be that, a million different things could happen with this experiment. You could plan to abstain and then find that you're actually not able to do it, which is useful information suggesting this is not actually within your volitional control. Or you might abstain for 30 days and feel no worse or no better at the end of it. That's also useful information. But there's also potentially a good chance that if you abstain for 30 days, you might feel a whole lot better, in which case now you're armed with a whole bunch of data that's really useful information and now provides the motivation for that individual themselves to make different decisions. And typically, when my patients are able to abstain for 30 days and feel better, which is about 80% of patients, they usually want to go back to using their drug of choice, like alcohol, but they want to use differently. They want to use less, and they want to use in a way that demonstrates more control. And so then we talk about, okay, what exactly is that going to look like? You know, when will you use? How much will you use? What will you use? In what situations will you use? And then once they're armed with sort of that very specific sort of ways of limiting and tracking use, along with a whole lot of self-binding strategies, then they see how it goes. You know, and some people are able to do it. Some people, once they go back to drinking, are right back in their addictive use. That's called the abstinence violation syndrome. Sometimes it's even worse than before, you know, which is one of the risks to trying moderation. But again, it's information, right? Information on the basis of which we can continue to make informed decisions so that person can, you know, have their best life.
I want to talk about some of the self-binding strategies that you write about in the book. What is chemical self-binding?
So self-binding broadly is the ways of creating barriers between ourselves and our drug of choice so we can press the pause button between desire and consumption. If we wait until we're in the throes of desire to put up barriers, we won't put them up. We'll just engage. But if those barriers are there earlier, then we'll be more likely to be able to enlist our willpower to abstain or to moderate. Chemical self-binding has to do with creating these barriers at the literal receptor or cellular level. We now have a number of different medications that are FDA approved to treat various forms of addiction, namely alcohol addiction, nicotine addiction, and opioid addiction. And those work by creating kind of barriers between ourselves and either the actual experience of the drug at the receptor level or a modification of the reinforcing effects of that drug at that level. So, for example, for alcohol addiction, naltrexone is an opioid receptor blocker that can work to help people either abstain from alcohol or moderate alcohol use. And you would think, well, why would blocking the opioid receptor work on alcohol? Because alcohol is not an opioid, it's alcohol. But the way that alcohol works in the brain is to stimulate and trigger our endogenous opioid system. So when people take naltrexone and it blocks the opioid receptor and they take a drink, very often they find that the drink is not as reinforcing. And so they're less likely to want a second or a third or a fourth drink. I had a patient who said, I didn't even really realize I was addicted to alcohol till I started taking naltrexone, looked at a six pack and did not feel like drinking the whole six pack. Huh. So that was his aha moment.
That seems like it could be a good strategy for those people who feel like they want to get their drinking under control and they feel really strongly about it in the morning. And then maybe, you know, 5, 6 o'clock comes and they find it impossible to say no to whatever it is they're used to drinking every day.
Right. And that gets to the problem of relying on willpower on its own. So willpower is, you know, not an infinite resource. It's actually like working the muscle of the brain. We wake up with more willpower than we have at the end of the day. And very often people will report, you know, waking up determined not to use and then at the end of the day find themselves using. So that's why these self-binding strategies are so important, so that we're not relying entirely on willpower.
What is chronological self-binding?
Chronological self-binding is a way to use time as a self-binding measure. This is especially useful for people who want to moderate. So, for example, people who want to moderate food consumption might use intermittent fasting. That's a way of having time restrictions around consumption. I actually think the intermittent fasting that's become popular for food is a really good digital form of self-binding, kind of intermittent fasting with digital products, whether it's the smartphone itself or certain things that we do online, sort of saying to ourselves, well, I'll use this online content or this online product between these hours of the day, but not outside of those hours, or maybe taking a digital fast one day a week when I won't go on my phone or won't go on email or won't go on Twitter or whatever it is, social media. So chronological binding is a way to use time to frame limits.
And categorical self-binding?
Yeah, categorical self-binding has to do with establishing certain categories within an umbrella category. So, for example, I had a patient who got addicted to video games. And after a period of abstinence, when he was feeling much better and stronger, he decided he wanted to go back to playing video games, but he decided that he couldn't play certain video games like League of Legends because that was just way too addictive for him. He also discovered that if he played with strangers instead of friends, he was much more likely to use beyond the point that he wanted to. So he created these kind of categories of safe use that included only certain video games and included playing only with friends, not with strangers. So that's just one example of the many ways in which we can sort of divide a larger category into subcategories of safer use.
How does categorical self-binding work for people, or not work for people, who struggle with consuming more food than they need?
So categorical self-binding is often used to address certain types of food addictions. For example, people will say, well, I'm not going to eat sugar, or I'm not going to eat gluten, or I'm not going to eat, you know, whatever it is, sort of parsing food groups and restricting access to certain food groups. The problem today is that just, you know, as soon as we've sort of created these categories, our capitalistic consumer-oriented industry has modified those categories to make them supposedly healthy in a new way. So gluten is a great example. A lot of people in the past 20 years have given up gluten products either because they have celiac disease and they're truly intolerant, or they just feel healthier not using gluten. But over the past 20 years, the gluten industry, which is a billion-dollar industry, has now made more and more gluten-free cakes and cookies. So what was previously potentially a way to avoid things like, cakes and cookies is now no longer a way to do that because there are so many gluten-free cakes and cookies for sale.
All right, I want to go to the phones now. First up, in Denton, Texas, we have James on the line. Hi, James.
Hi. I'm really enthralled by all of this. I just want to say I'm a 25-year-old living here in Denton, college student. And I've lived with ADHD for my whole life, and I wanted to know if there is, you know, I've heard before that, like, ADHD is a sort of dopamine disorder of sorts, and I wanted to know if you had any input on ADHD and its connection, because I know that I have a lot of, like, addictive tendencies as well.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks, James. That's a great question. So we know that people with ADHD as children are at higher risk of addiction in adulthood. And the way we think this works is that the prefrontal cortex, which is this gray matter area right behind our foreheads, that's so important for delayed gratification and future planning, and which communicates with the pleasure-pain balance in the nucleus accumbens area, the communication between the prefrontal cortex and the emotion and reward centers is really vital for a healthy consumption. And what can happen in ADHD is that it's essentially a disorder of the prefrontal cortex, a disorder related to cognition and planning and impulse control. And so it's not really a surprise that people with ADHD would struggle more with the gremlins and with the pleasure-pain balance kind of reflexively driving the bus, because they have a prefrontal cortex that may not work quite as well as those without ADHD. But the good news is that there are things that you can do to strengthen your prefrontal cortex. And one of them is this idea of radical honesty by telling the truth about things large and small. You're probably exercising the prefrontal cortex. You know, all of us lie. The average adult tells 1 to 2 lies per day. It's usually about little things that we think don't matter. But if you just pose for yourself the challenge of trying to go through an entire day without telling a single lie, you'll be surprised how hard it is. But it's a great way to work out your prefrontal cortex and strengthen it, and then potentially help with the problem of compulsive overconsumption.
Do people with ADHD do better in sort of controlling their dopamine balance if they are taking medication to relieve the symptoms of ADHD, help them concentrate?
This is a great question, and the answer is no. Hmm. So there was, for a while, there were several papers published, one of them out of Harvard that's now been essentially debunked, that said that if you have a cohort of kids with ADHD and you treat those kids with stimulants, then they're less likely to go on and develop the problem of addiction. And in fact, that's been shown not to be true, that stimulants prescribed in childhood are not protective when it comes to developing addiction later in life in kids with ADHD. And frankly, in my clinical experience, I think that early exposure to stimulants might even be a risk factor, as some individuals who are put on stimulants will go on to misuse and become addicted to those stimulants.
So if that is the case, do we also need to sort of rethink the idea that we instantly reach for a medication whenever our brains aren't functioning just like everybody else's?
Yes, we definitely need to rethink that idea on so many levels. First of all, a lot of these medications, although they can be life-saving in certain situations, and I prescribe them, there's really no good evidence that when used long-term, they work long-term. And as we've talked about, when we're prescribing potentially addictive medications like opioids or benzos or stimulants, we're potentially putting that individual at risk, because of giving them access. And remember, access is a risk factor for developing addiction. But more importantly, I think we need to really think more broadly about, what constitutes psychopathology. And I think we're really far too quick to diagnose people with psychopathology. And instead, we should be looking at different ways to educate people with different types of brains.
I really appreciated that you shared in the book that you had to simply come to terms with the fact that by nature, you're a somewhat anxious, somewhat depressed person, pretty skeptical. What changed for you when you decided to accept that rather than constantly pursuing a way to kind of fix yourself?
Yeah, it was really, a pivotal moment because it was, first of all, kind of a self-acceptance, which felt good and true and real. And it was the end of this kind of striving to be somebody other than I am. It was an appreciation for the people who tolerate me despite, my flaws. And I think it was also more broadly this recognition that like we're all deeply flawed in some ways. And that's also just part of humanity and part of life. And of course, it doesn't mean that we celebrate our flaws, but, there's a level on which, we just kind of accept who we are, including, if we're prone to dysphoria, just sort of learning to kind of sit with that pain or that depression or that anxiety, really turn and look at it and go, oh, okay, yeah, that's sort of what my brain does. And then because we're not running from it or trying to eliminate it, there's an ability to get a certain degree of detachment from it, which is its own form of relief.
All right, let's go to the phones. We have Sean on the line in Austin, Texas. Hi, Sean.
Hi there. I thank you for taking my call. This is a revelation to me. As somebody who was a childhood trauma survivor, was eventually diagnosed with every kind of pain disorder known to man in my 20s, was like, I can't even start. But then eventually being diagnosed with fibromyalgia, I was eventually, I was on opioids all through my 20s and 30s and was eventually on a fentanyl patch. I got myself off of that and have been on Suboxone for the last 15 years. What is your understanding of fibromyalgia? Because what all they suggest is everything you are suggesting, increase in exercise, yada, yada, yada. But quite honestly, there's a hopelessness.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah. So, well, thank you. First of all, you've been on a very difficult and courageous journey, dealing with chronic pain, fibromyalgia, and getting off of a fentanyl patch. Oh my goodness, the withdrawal from that is tremendous. And then ultimately, getting on Suboxone, which of course is treatment for opioid dependence. So thank you for sharing that. And my respect goes to you for having, walked that hard walk. Fibromyalgia is really a mystery. We don't know what causes it. We do think ultimately that it's a disease in the brain and not in the actual body, although the body experiences the pain. And, why it comes about? I mean, I do have my own theories, and they're shared by some, that in some ways it's the sort of, that people with fibromyalgia may be innately more sensitive to pain and to sensory painful experiences. And then I also think that it may be a result of this kind of detachment from the body that then ultimately manifests as pain in the brain. But the good news is that because fibromyalgia is likely a brain disease, a central nervous system disease, things that work include things that change the central nervous system. So things like exercise, which will upregulate your dopamine and also your endogenous opioids. You know, you could even consider taking low-dose naltrexone. Well, actually, you can't because you're on Suboxone, and that's an opioid. But sometimes people with fibromyalgia take an opioid receptor blocker, which then tricks the body into upregulating its own endogenous opioids. You know, doing things that sort of internally readjust the central nervous system, individual psychotherapy, group psychotherapy, any mind-body work that allows you to kind of tolerate your pain. Those are all the things that are recommended for fibromyalgia.
I want to go back to this idea, you know, if pleasure causes our brains to try and reach homeostasis by generating a dose of something a bit painful, how much does it work the other way? Can pain trigger the brain to balance itself by releasing hormones that make us feel pleasure?
Indeed, it can. And this is really an exciting area of science called hormesis. Hormesis is Greek for to set in motion. And there's a wealth of evidence showing that if we engage in mild to moderate noxious stimuli, we essentially set in motion our own body's healing mechanisms. So, for example, by going into an ice cold water bath or doing, you know, exercise, what we're doing is we're injuring our body, our tissues, our cells, and our body in response is unleashing its own healing forces, like upregulating dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine, our endocannabinoid system, our endo-opioid system. So this is a very powerful and, you know, proven way to restore dopamine homeostasis and to develop a resilient pleasure-pain balance. So an important caveat to that, if we press too hard and too long on the pain side, then we essentially turn it into an intoxicant and people can get addicted to pain. So I've seen people with exercise addiction. I've seen people who cut on themselves, which releases our own endogenous opioids. And that's obviously a maladaptive way of using pain. But if we use pain in mild to moderate doses at the level to which we have developed tolerance, it can be a really great way to upregulate our own healing mechanism.
Okay, let's go next on the phone to Julie, calling us from Denver. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, I think that this is all really great in terms of the personal responsibility aspect of all of this. People go to therapy and they go to recovery and they go get help because they want to improve themselves. But there's a little bit of a pushback in terms of what is society's role in creating some of these things. And, you know, the idea of people wouldn't get high if they weren't low to begin with. And society's role in, you know, being part of this whole process addiction, all these type of things. And so what is the response to that pushback to, it's not all just personal responsibility.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, so that's a great point, Julie. And I think if I could rephrase it, what you're pushing back against is my saying that it's the drugs themselves that are creating the addiction. And you're saying, you know, no, in fact, it's life circumstances that are causing people to reach for the drugs. And I think both of those things are simultaneously true. You know, people live, you know, horrible lives that they have little ability to materially change. And of course, that means that people are more likely to reach for intoxicants to try to get out of that kind of suffering. But whatever the window or door is into reaching for the substance in the first place, what cannot be denied is that these substances are so much more potent, so much more plentiful, so much more accessible than they ever have been in human history. And that no matter our starting point neurobiologically, even if we start out with a pleasure-pain balance tilted to the side of pain, the gremlins work the same way. And so that reaching for a substance to try to escape our suffering initially will work for a short period of time, but will ultimately lead to this dopamine deficit state that then engenders more suffering.
Anna, millions of Americans now use psychotropic medications, and yet reports of mood and anxiety disorders in this country just keep rising. What should we make of that?
Yeah, I think it's a really important question because we did have this idea that if we could just make mental health treatment more accessible, rates of anxiety, depression, and suicide would go down. And in fact, what you see across the globe is that in countries where there are more psychotropics being prescribed, there's less stigma around mental illness and more access to mental health care treatment, you actually see, sadly, higher rates of depression, anxiety, and suicide, or at least no lowering of those rates. And I think that really compels us to ask what else may be going on here. And that's essentially the hypothesis of Dopamine Nation, which is to say it is this relentless pursuit of pleasure in an ecosystem in which pleasure is infinitely accessible that leads to the neurobiological dopamine deficit state that is akin to clinical depression. And that, in fact, what may actually be driving our individual and collective misery is the fact that we have too much pleasure.
All right, let's go now on the phone to Yuma, Arizona. Nathan is on the line there. Hi, Nathan.
Hi. I have been thoroughly enjoying the program so far. This is all stuff I've just been figuring out and working on philosophically and metaphysically, and it's great to put it in scientific and neurological terms. My question, I have a lot of friends who are struggling with depression and addiction and just dopamine dependency and so many different forms, and I'd like to know what are ways that I can help them and support them? Like, I really like the idea of the honesty in terms of big and small, but what are some ways that I can help people get better themselves without simply saying, just stop scrolling or put that joint down or who knows what else?
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you, Nathan. What happens once people become addicted is that they only see two pathways in their life. They see either they continue to use and thereby at least get some intermittent relief from their suffering, or they stop using and live a life of abject misery. So one of the important messages to communicate is that there's actually a third way. And the third way is a path in which the substance is not used, and yet it is not a life of abject misery, and that there's this promise, the promise of recovery, that is a life that is so much better than the life of addiction. And so we have to continually remind people it's not a choice between using and being miserable. There's a third way that is a life of recovery, that is a powerfully healing and I don't want to say happy experience, but where life's meaning really sort of envelops one, and we are able to live this life of meaning and purpose, which at least makes life tolerable and worth hanging around for.
Your points earlier about the importance of radical honesty about ourselves make a lot of sense. And yet, I don't know many people who sort of willfully say, I'm going to be in denial about this. How can we know if we are in denial to therefore get out of denial?
That's a great point, because that's the whole point of denial, that we don't even know we're lying. And that's an acronym that I love that was taught to me by one of my patients. This is where telling another human being what we're doing can be extraordinarily helpful. So when I work with patients, the first thing that I will ask, when I'm getting to know them, among many other questions about who they are and their lives, is, what are you using? How much are you using? When are you using? What is the thing that, you're using to kind of escape from yourself or your life? And something very remarkable happens when people put into words in an honest way what they're actually doing with their time. It becomes real in a way it's not when it's just kind of pinging around in their heads. So whether they're telling someone like me, a psychiatrist, or telling a friend, or telling somebody else with the same problem in a peer recovery group, this really remarkable thing, a kind of a lifting of the veil, happens when we put into words to another human being what we're actually consuming, how much, when. And so that's one of the important ways to kind of get out of this space of denial.
Anna, this has been really interesting. Thanks very much for making the time to talk with us.
Oh, my goodness. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Anna Lemke is Medical Director of Stanford Addiction Medicine and Chief of the Stanford Addiction Medicine Dual Diagnosis Clinic. Her book is called Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. She joined us in February. If you like this show, you should listen to our conversation with addiction physician and bioethicist Carl Eric Fisher, author of The Urge, Our History of Addiction, and check out our show with author Maya Salovitz, who joined us to talk about her book, Undoing Drugs, The Untold Story of Harm Reduction and the Future of Addiction. You can like our page on Facebook. We are at KERA Think on Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast for free wherever you get your podcasts, or go to our website where you can also see upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.